Hello, this is Kay Ballard, and you are listening to Women Are Not Funny Radio. Today we will be talking with our very special guest, and that is author Susan Piver, who has a new book, The Wisdom of a Broken Heart, An Uncommon Guide to Healing Insight and Love. Now, you may be asking, and if you are Renee, you will be asking, certainly, what on earth is funny about heartbreak? Well, here is the answer. I don't know. Maybe nothing. Maybe there is nothing funny about heartbreak. But I do have an open mind, and I'm willing to find out. So that's what we'll do today. But first, I have a few things to cover. Item number one. Did you notice that we still don't have our Women Are Not Funny Season 2 voiceover intro? We have our theme music, William Tell Tricycle, which is an arrangement that's heavy on the glockenspiel of Rossini's William Tell Overture. We like to call it NPR meets Romper Room. Well, for those of you who are keeping score, the fact that we don't have our voiceover intro means that the score is voiceover artist 4, K0. But in defense of our voiceover artist, let me say she's busy working on other very exciting projects for me and for my company. So, item number 2. Last week I talked about my discovery that I myself was following the very annoying Ann Curry interview method. And that is my name for the method where the person doing the interview loves the sound of her own voice so much that she does all the talking. She loves her own ideas so much that she rattles on and on and on and never really gets to the guest. Well, I worked hard not to do this, and I think I succeeded to some extent last week in my conversation with Heidi Neybert. And yes, I'm actually giving myself props. There's just no end to the conceit that you can engage in when you're hosting your own radio show. But today, I must once again be on guard, because today I am totally wrapped up in the subject. I'm fascinated by Susan's work and even more fascinated by my fascination with it. The thing that may save me, and the only thing that may save me, is that Susan is a friend. And I'm going to encourage her as a friend, when necessary, to say, "Shut up, Kay, and let me talk." This is Divorce Month on Women Are Not Funny. And the reason for it, the reason for Divorce Month is I decided it would be. And my reason for deciding that it would be is totally self-serving. I have written and performed a comedy piece called KK's Divorce, which is coupled with the Paula Kelly song, I'd Fall in Love with Anyone. And it's being produced by Drummer Hill Press and will be launched on Valentine's Day, February 14th. So in an obvious move to promote my CD, we made February Divorce Month on Women Are Not Funny. As you know, life is full of serendipity, and this overt effort at self-promotion resulted in a huge benefit, and that is that it gave us an excellent reason to invite today's guest, Susan Piver. Susan's latest book is called The Wisdom of a Broken Heart, An Uncommon Guide to Healing, Insight, and Love, and it is wonderful. So as I was telling Susan a few minutes ago, not only do I have to fight the Ann Curry interview method, I also have to work hard not to sound like an infomercial, because I love her book so much that I will be telling you that and telling you, oh, you should read it, you should buy it. It's really that good. Susan, hello. How are you today?
I am good, Kate. It's so nice to be with you.
Well, thank you. And I take that as the compliment it was intended to be. I know you have been everywhere promoting your book, including this morning you were on radio. And where was that? Were you in Portland? Did I have that right?
Yeah, I'm in Portland right now. And did it sound like I said Kate? Because I meant to say, I thought I heard myself say that, but of course I did not mean to say that.
You know what? I love the name Kate. I actually like it better than Kay, so please call me Kate anytime. I called you earlier. I called you Susan Spiver, which is really ridiculous, but you understand why I do, and that's because we Twitter together, and on Twitter, you are Spiver. At any rate, it is. That's how we met.
Exactly. That's how we met, and I bet we've known each other. I feel like I've known you for 2 years, although we've never seen each other, but we're in each other's lives on a daily basis, I would say.
Yeah, we really are, and it's just been we briefly discussed the fact that I think it's frequently annoying to people to listen to people on internet radio talk about how they met. But I am convinced our story, it's two things, Susan. It's both usual and ordinary. You know, that's the thing that's so crazy about it. Everything about it is so wild, and it happens day after day and time after time in the social media. It's such an exciting time to be alive. Don't you agree with that?
I agree. It's ordinary, and it's exceptional, and it's a delight.
It is a delight, and shortly after I met you on Twitter, you were so kind. You sent me a chapter of your book via email, and one of the reasons I responded to your request for some readers is that I was suffering from a broken heart myself at the time, so I was very interested in reading your book. And we had several conversations on telephone and certainly many more on Twitter. We talked about the Kindle, and, you know, you bought a Kindle. We had a lot of conversations relative to the presidential election, and we were on the same side, so that made it, you know, that made our conversations a lot more fun. And that we had some conversations on phone. And here's something our listeners may find terribly interesting. They know that I have formed many business relationships through my work on Twitter and my opportunities on Twitter. But you and I actually explored a business relationship, and it didn't happen. So that's also possible. But our friendship has remained. And since that time, I have watched you as your book has come out and the purchase of your home. I'm aware of different social things you do, all of your retreats. So, I feel like I know you very well, and actually do know you so much better than I know a lot of people that I have met face to face.
I know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. And Twitter was actually really a part of this book, because the whole time I was writing it, I would tweet my sort of concerns and my doubts and my excitement and my when I was trying to write and it was working, and when I was trying and it wasn't, and when I got the cover, I shared it with everyone on Twitter. What do you think? I polled maybe obnoxiously, repetitively, what are people's ideas for the subtitle before we actually came up with one? And then, just like you say, I asked if anyone would be interested in reading, would volunteer to read a chapter and give me some feedback. And people did, and I used that feedback. And, you know, really when the book came out, the first place I wanted to tell people, hey, I'm holding my book in my hands, was Twitter.
Well, no doubt. And, you know, I'm sure I'm not the only one who enjoyed being part of that process. The interesting thing, though, Susan, is, and I have to tell listeners this, the term best-selling author is one that is trotted out far too frequently. Most of the time when it is used, or a lot of the time when it's used, it's just hyperbole. And in Susan's case, it's not hype. This woman is not only a best-selling author, she is over and over again. And Susan, I think, you know, I'm going to get it wrong, so this is my opportunity to throw out a number and you correct me. Prior to this book, you have had 7 books, is that correct, published?
Well, yes, yes,
okay.
I have written 5 books myself, and I have, like, collaborated or edited, you know, maybe 3 or 4 more. So I don't know if I would say I wrote them, but I edited them or I compiled them or whatever. My name's on the spine, so.
Well, there you go. And the other thing is, these are not self-published books. These are books that are published by major publishing houses. And your current publisher for the new book is Simon & Schuster. And so these are the big houses, and Susan has done all of the things that you would associate with a true best-selling author. She has been on all of the talk shows, including Oprah. She does a lot of radio and a lot of press. So she is, you know, in terms of the Ann Curry message, she may have been interviewed by Ann Curry.
I was.
Maybe didn't experience the horror. I'm being a little cruel to Ann Curry, but, you know, it's permitted. The reason it's permitted is because I permit myself, okay? You don't have to agree with me, Susan.
Well, I'm cruel to her because she's, you know, we're around the same age, and she just looks completely beautiful and ageless. And every time I see a picture of her, I'm like, how did she do that? I'm very upset with this Ann Curry.
She is amazingly beautiful, and that is just one of the reasons to resent her. You know,
exactly.
I have a whole list, and so that's what I do. But, you know, one of the things that I'd like to talk about that's related to what we're saying before we get into the heart of your book, if you will, since you have been out there in press for a long time, and since you tend to be open about your life, certainly in this most recent book you are, do you think you're ahead of some of us in terms of being able to be public about your personal life? Some of us who are just, you know, are doing that in social media for the first time, you've actually been doing it in print and for a period of time.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I never thought about that. And certainly it's different. You know, it's easier in a sense to be open in a book because you send it out. The book goes and lives its life in other people's houses. You know, hopefully you don't have any idea. Nobody talks back to you when you write the book, you know, unless maybe they email you or whatever. But, in, you know, social media, of course, it's different. It's about ongoing relationships. And authors, many of us, for good reason, are introverted and like to spend time and solitary, and it suits us. But my reliance on my personal life is more than mere, you know, self-absorption. It certainly is self-absorption, but it's more than self-absorption, too, because I write about my personal experience because that's all I have. I'm not I'm not an academic. I'm not a therapist. I didn't even go to college. Please don't tell anyone. And I don't, so I can't, like, lean back on any expertise particularly. But what I can do, and what I actually enjoy reading the most myself when other people do this is write from my personal experience. Like, I have explored these, what I think are profound ideas from being a seeker and a reader and blah, blah, blah all my life. And this is what it felt like to try to apply them to an ordinary life. And I personally, I learn more from people's personal stories than I do from any kind of theoretical or conceptual, you know, outline. I don't respond to those. So anyway, all I have is my personal experience, and it's also what I feel is, you know, it's just what I think about, so I don't really have anything else to write about.
Well, and your stories are very personal, and they are very engaging, and, it feels, to me as a reader, it feels very I don't feel manipulated, but it is very seductive to be reading the words of someone who is so open and willing to let us into her personal life. Another thing that strikes me about this book, Susan, is the way you say just very, very much at the beginning that it is a book by a woman directed at women, and you don't want to exclude men, but in this book, men are the other. And so that's another thing that was very, you know, very, very interesting to me. I talked about the fact that you are a true best-selling author, but one of the things that is interesting and amazing and would probably be surprising to people who don't know this, and I have to admit I already knew, but just how hard you work. Just the level of commitment you have to your book and to your ideas. So it's not only something that you just fell in love with when you held it in your hands and shared that story with us, but now you are on a little love affair, kind of a honeymoon with it, as you go around the country promoting it. And so tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's been very amazing. And I'm 1 month into a 2 month book tour. And I'm sitting in a hotel room in Portland, Oregon right now, which is quite a lovely town, but I live in Boston. And I got here in a car because I just got it into my head. And I love my publisher, and I'm not just saying that because I want to write more books for them. They are great. I love my editor. The publicist who's working it is doing an amazing job, and they're setting up book signings pretty much wherever they can, wherever I go. But the publishing industry is pretty much off of book tours because, A, everybody's struggling financially, and, B, the sort of conventional wisdom is they may or may not sell books, and they're very expensive. But I got it into my head that this was the way to promote this topic, that I couldn't afford to stay home and, you know, wait for Oprah to call me or something, you know, or just wait for something to happen, that the topic is so intimate and so, you know, hot, you know, when you feel it, it's so difficult and painful, that I felt like to go out and talk to people who are experiencing it and try to be helpful was going to be the best way, A, for me to honor the ideas in the book, but also, B, to make it successful, because I really want it to be successful. And so I just booked myself on this crazy tour, driving from Boston around the country up to Vancouver and back. I'm giving talks almost every night and doing book signings at least a couple a week. And I'm meeting people with broken hearts and talking about the topic every day. And I hope that it will create, and relying on Twitter and Facebook, and between all of these things, you know, the only way to really count on selling a book for anybody who's interested in writing a book is word of mouth. You can't count on publicity. You can't count on a bookstore being interested in it. You can't count on anything. There's only thing that lasts, that has legs, is word of mouth. So I thought, how am I going to make word of mouth on this book? And this was the way I thought to do it. So here I am.
Well, it is crazy. And actually, Twitter and Facebook are not the only social media that you are using, because you have these videos on YouTube that you did. And now, Susan, these are just amazing to me, and I have to tell you, I don't want to cause you any sort of insecurity, but my first thought, years ago, when I first started being a public person, I would do some, you know, in different roles I was in, I would do some news conferences, and that was back in the day when the video cameras were gigantic, and the guys who were filming you would videoing you would be have this huge apparatus that they would use, and they would get right under my face, and I would call it nostril cam, you know, because it was just really bothersome to me, the thought that this camera was, you know, at that angle. And so when I watched your videos on YouTube, it's interesting. You put the camera somewhere on the dashboard of the car, and you're making videos while you're driving down the highway.
It's a flattering angle. I got it. I know. It's the only place I could put my iPhone where it wouldn't fall down.
No, I tell you what, it is. It's not unflattering. You look terrific, but that was my first thought. Is, oh my goodness, nostril cam, and I just thought, how great that Susan's not, you know, not insecure, and you're certainly not. And while they're not humorous per se, there's just something so fun and ironic about it that we are watching a video being made in the car by a best-selling author who is going down the road on her book tour, and it's just great. And so not only are you very public about that, and actually some of your thoughts on those are really rather deep, but not only are you very public about it, you're also being willing to be public about the fact that you don't always have a huge audience. And that's something else that I love, you know, that I find ironic. And so I would encourage anyone listening to this, speaking of a huge audience, we actually have millions of listeners today, by the way. But I would try to persuade those millions to go to YouTube, and you can simply do a search for Susan Piver, and you will turn up all kinds of videos, including her road trip videos, which are just really fun to listen to. So anyway, I'm an advocate of that. The whole idea, I remember at the time we were talking about your book tour on Twitter, I said something like, I just wondered if people would sneak in. They wouldn't want to be associated with having a broken heart. Have you found that to be the case?
No, yes and no. I mean, I think people might not come rather than sneak in because it's too embarrassing. Mm-hmm. But I've been giving, if there's some point, and everyone who has ever had a broken heart, which is basically everyone, can tell you, is that there's some times when you can handle it, and then there's some times when you're desperate. You will do anything to try to, you know, ease the pain, which is so real and so deep. So people that never read self-help books find themselves trolling the self-help section at midnight, and people that would never meditate try to learn it, or people that, you know, would never do certain things. You're just like, what will help? I will try anything. And I think that's a good impulse, actually. And so people that are at that point tend to show up at my talks. And they've actually been the most well-attended talks that I've ever done. You know, I can't count on, I'm sort of the opposite of many authors. Like, I can get on television, but I can't necessarily draw an audience to a talk. For most self-help authors, they go the other way. They draw people, and then they get on television. And they find that hard. But for whatever reason, it's been the opposite for me in my career. But so I can't always count. This is a long-winded way of saying I don't always count on people actually showing up when I appear at somewhere. But this has been, like, a lot of people. So I really honor them, the courage to show up. And I appreciate that they're trying to do something, and I also really value hearing their stories, because and what you've alluded to, and I find it very it's actually a compliment, the openness and the honesty is like, A, who has time for anything else? Life is short, might as well tell the truth. And B, people who have a broken heart don't know how to do anything else. You all you want to do is talk about how you feel. So people have been very generous and brave to come forward with their stories, and I appreciate hearing them, and I learn from them.
Yeah, well, no doubt, and that was one of the things that you talk about, certainly in your videos from the car driving down the road. But, you know, this is divorce month on Women Are Not Funny, and your book does not deal specifically with divorce. Divorce is only one way to have a broken heart. But it is very clear, there are lots of ways to have a broken heart. It's very clear that your book is truly about the broken heart that one experiences when a love relationship ends. And one of the things that you point out is that all love relationships are going to end, either by a loss of some sort, death, or another loss, a goodbye, a painful goodbye. But then what about the ending, what about one that ends in ambivalence? What do you say about that?
Yeah, that in a sense it's easier. You mean like people just sort of are like, sometimes they're together, sometimes they're not, or you're unclear about whether this person wants to be with you, but you can still hang out and whatever it is. You know, I don't know. I think you're still in the relationship. The breakup is when one person says, I don't want to do this anymore, whatever this is. Whether it's you see each other, you know, only after midnight on Saturdays, or you live together for 25 years. One person says, whatever we're doing here, I'm stopping. So then that's what this book is pretty much geared towards. They're not saying that the other ambivalent relationships are not painful. They are. But you don't get the qualities particularly that you get when the relationship is over.
Right. Like, and you talk very much about the pain that's unconsolable, the pain that is so difficult, that is actually physical. And it actually, your heart actually physically hurts.
It does. It is, your chest, it can feel like someone's sitting on it all day long. It is so uncomfortable. And, you know, this may sound cavalier, but I thought, boy, if someone could bottle this, this would be the most amazingly effective diet book because you lose 10 pounds. Like, you just turn around, you lost 10 pounds because you can't eat. So
yeah.
It's like the heartbreak diet. If you have a friend who's, you know, you suddenly see them and they have, looks like, hey, you lost 10 pounds. Oh, it looks like you cut all your hair off. That person just had a breakup. Because those are like two things that, you know, tend to happen.
Yeah, that's an interesting theory. Well, you talk specifically about a relationship that was very important in your life and remains important. And that was the, you know, really the crux of this book, or the reason you started dealing with the whole issue and subject of heartbreak. And your words are so beautiful, but these words just really knocked me out. The feeling, and you're talking about the fact, I'll just tell listeners that she talks a lot about this breakup that happened years back, and since then she has married and is happily married, and dedicates her book to her husband, talks about the heartbreak of marriage. I love that. But she says the feeling of heartbreak that returns because you were born with that person in your heart.
I knew you were going to say it. I think it's something like we broke up and it was so devastating, and it's the love you can never excise because you were born with that person already in your heart. There's some loves that are like that, and it's real, it's true, and
mm-hmm.
it is, how do you get rid of the person that was born already in you? So that's a heartbreak.
And it actually makes love very scary, doesn't it? Because the stakes are so high. You're talking about loving someone who's always been in your heart. You're talking about the fact that it is inevitable that it is going to end in some form or fashion. So it really does truly take, as you say, a tender-hearted warrior, the wisdom of a tender-hearted warrior. Talk about that.
Yes. So exactly as you say, there is no relationship that is not going to end in heartbreak, whether because someone says goodbye or someone dies. And in a sense, you know, the more you love, the more heartbreaking it becomes. And you see, and you certainly see it when your heart is broken, that there is actually no way to make love safe. And most people, when they say they want love, they don't mean that. They mean they want safe. They want someone to cocoon with. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. That's a beautiful, lovely thing to be able to do with someone. But it tends to go further than that for most of us. Like, I want a relationship so that I don't have to feel alone. I don't have to worry about this. You're looking for someone more as a device than an actual being to love. But love is the opposite of safe. It's completely vulnerable, and there's nothing you can do to make it safe, even though we try very hard and we make demands and, like, you need to show up on my birthday in this kind of happy suit or whatever ideas that we tell the other person they have to conform to. But so the bad news is it's inevitable. The good news is it's inevitable, so you can relax. You can relax. And to manage that, by the way, I don't mean to be cavalier about it, but to manage that knowledge that you get when your heart is broken, that love can never be safe, yet I long for love, to bring those two things together into your world and find a way to know that you're vulnerable and love anyway, knowing that it will be heartbreaking at some point, that is a warrior. That is a person who has connected with a kind of courage that comes from tenderness, not from a sense of invincibility. And that is a beautiful thing. And, you know, who doesn't want to be loved by someone like that? That's real love. It's not safe. It's wild, and you cannot domesticate it. And, you know, it burns, and it's what we live for. So, you know, go for it.
Well, Susan, I love that. And speaking for everyone in the world, as I have been designated to do, you know, we don't think that way. We don't talk that way. We don't understand that way, and we need to. Don't you agree with that? We need to think that way.
I really do, and not because it's right, but because it works, because it's the truth, and because it makes you able to love. And, you know, like you said, I dedicated the book to my husband, you know, for the journey of heartbreak called marriage. And it's not heartbreaking because like, we disappoint each other in normal, everyday ways, which we certainly do. But it's heartbreaking because the more I love him, the more precious. It's like anyone who's a parent knows this, that you sense the vulnerability of the person you love, like, day in and day out. And it's very hard to contemplate. So it's heartbreaking to love that much because you know that person is vulnerable and things are vulnerable and blah, blah, blah. But you know what's so interesting to me is when you look at all the heartbreak books or all the love books that are out there and what they do tell us, like you were sort of alluding to a moment ago, please go and look at your own bookshelf or the self-help section of a bookstore or whatever and see if you see what I did, which is that every book about love is about how to get it, with the idea being, once I get it, then I'm going to give it. 0% are about how to give love, like none. I thought that when I realized that, I'm like, that is pretty weird. None of them are about how to give it. So, you know, someone needs to write those books.
Exactly. You stated that in your in one of your videos on the road trip, and I was fascinated by that when you said it, because it really is true. You would think that there would be a good reason for people who want to receive love to really work at learning how to give it in a very competent way, that's for sure. What, you know, one of the things I in working on this project, KK's divorce. In fact, how do you feel about that? Doing a CD about your divorce is a way to combat heartbreak. Do you think that's a good thing?
I love it.
Anyway, we with my producer, we have a making of KK's divorce as part of the CD, and so I was talking about the fact that it's really strange, given that so many marriages end in divorce, that little girls plan their dream wedding, but they never plan their dream divorce. Mm-hmm. And so, while we all know we'd like to be married wearing a Vera Wang wedding dress, we ought to be looking for that Karl Lagerfeld outfit to wear as we're walking out the door. And I do think that, you know, your whole concept of knowing that this is an inevitable part of love is a very important thing for us to be communicating both to ourselves and others. One of your best-selling books is 100 Essential Questions to Ask Before You Say I Do. And I have to say, I did not read that book. So that is probably, it was written after I said I do, but you know, it's probably a good idea. At the time I got married, I was very much a proponent of the skydiving theory of marriage, where you just, you say, this is a commitment so dangerous, I'm going to just jump out of the plane without a parachute for the sheer fun of it. That was kind of my theory. But I think probably your book about 100 Essential Questions to Ask might be a better way to go.
Well, some combination is probably required, because at some point you got to take the leap. And, you know, at another point you're like, what actually am I doing here? Not just because I want to take care of myself, but what am I going to do with this other person? You know, what about them? They got to think about them too. So it's a shocking revelation when you're married. You actually have to think about the other person. I was quite taken aback by that, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, I want to go to your heartbreaking love relationship that the book kind of centers around, or it inspired the book, let's say. Is that a fair way to consider it, your love relationship with the guitar player?
Absolutely.
You know, it was interesting. Having grown up in Texas, I also am a Stevie Ray Vaughan fan, and your lover was a guitar player and apparently played with Stevie Ray Vaughan and taught you a lot about music. And it just brings me to the question of the power of music in love relationships.
Wow, that's a great, great, great point. That's so interesting. Yeah, that's deep. I mean, it's more than you have your friends that you love together.
I love hearing that I'm deep, but it does. Music conjures up feelings like nothing else can. Wouldn't you agree with that?
There's no question. To me, it's like the closest thing to, like, transformative and like spirit made visible, you know, or audible in this case, which sounds kind of woo-woo, but nonetheless, it's like it's just pure energetics, and I'm a huge, huge, huge music fan. In fact, I worked in the music business for like 10 years before I somehow accidentally became a writer.
Yeah, well, in your book, not only do you have a connection, was this relationship connected to music and the feelings you have for music, but you tell this wonderful story. I'm going to kind of start it and you can finish it, but I want our listeners to know that you deal with the fact that many times these relationships, we have so many things that are tied to experience and to sensory things like music, but there was a time after you had broken up and after you had moved along, so to speak, that you were leading a business meeting and you met in the restaurant, and the waitress brought to the table jalapeno cheese cornbread. And and that was kind of a setback for a moment, right?
Yes, it was a setback. I was like, yeah, I think I'm moving on here. This is good. I'm like at a restaurant. I'm fully clothed. I think I combed my hair sometime in the last 24 hours. And this is an exciting project we're here to talk about, and I like this food at this restaurant, and good, check, everything's good, all systems go, and then everything fell apart, like, suddenly, because the waitress diabolically brought to our table a basket of jalapeno cheddar cheese cornbread, and suddenly all I could think was, he liked jalapeno cheddar cheese cornbread. And then that thought made the whole thing crash. Everything came back, and I had to, like, push back from the table and try to run to the bathroom before anyone saw me crying. And I just started sobbing. And I remember sitting there in the stall thinking, oh, my God, a piece of bread has just upset my existence. I got a long way to go here.
Well, it's such, I mean, you know, I'm sure it was horrible at the time. It's an adorable story. It's a very funny story. And it's also, you know, it shows just the scariness of having deep emotions, that we can be thrown into a ditch by, like you said, a diabolical deed, like someone bringing jalapeno cheese cornbread to your table. It can happen all in a sudden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and, you know, when you have a person of strong emotion, and, you know, in some sense that's everybody, but in another sense there's some people that they just are born blessed and cursed with a very strong inner emotional life, strong emotional responses, or they lead with their emotional responses because it's just how they were born. And so people like that get short shrift in our world. We get made fun of and, you know, poo-pooed, and we scare other people. They're like, why are you getting so emotional? Or, you know, I remember the thing I heard most when I was a girl was, hey, why don't you smile? I would just want to slug to this day anyone who said that to me. Why are you so serious? Why are you intense? Why are you emotional? I'd be like, why aren't you?
That's funny. Well, we have that in common. I don't like that either when someone reminds me to smile. But anyway, I will say, though, a smile is a very good beauty treatment. You know, it works out. So, but, you know, one of the things that I was told, I went to see a counselor about a year and a half ago, and the main reason, it's really funny, the main reason I went to this particular counselor is she was someone in the community that I wanted to meet, you know, so I was interested in whatever wisdom she could bring me, but I also had some other motives for going to her, but she told me that I would never really get over having my marriage until I had another man in my life. And at the time, I was not very open to that idea. And what she said, and you'll appreciate this since you spent some time in Texas, she said, honey, if you had a bass boat, if you parked it in the town square, would you catch any bass? No, you have to put it out on the lake to catch a bass. So anyway, that,
I love that.
That was her way of telling me, you know, that you have to put your boat in the water, so to speak. But anyway, do you think that is really the best and the only way to get rid of a broken heart is to form another relationship?
Yes and no. I mean, it's not the only way, and it may not be the best way. But it is, you know, when you fall in love and you break up, I don't, as much as you might say, oh, I miss his smile, or I miss his or her or their, whatever, you know, strength, and all of that may be true on one level, but I think what you really miss is those moments of connection that are beyond words. Mm-hmm. And we will go a long way out of our way to find those, and rightfully so. And when you fall in love, I believe it's because you sense this, you know, connection, this possibility of being met in this very full kind of way, being seen, being embraced. And that is worth falling in love for. And when you break up, that's what you mourn. And how it's worth mourning. But when you, it's not the person that you're mourning, though, it's those moments. And I can prove that, I think I said in the book, because the moment you feel that possibility with someone else, the person who you now mourn will disappear from your mind mm-hmm. in the snap mm-hmm. of a fingers. And it's not because you didn't love them, it's because that's the magnetizing factor. And so in that sense, yes, falling in love with someone else is the best way, but it's not, in a more conventional view, there are many, many ways to get over it. And there's also some argument for never getting over it, because mm-hmm. it softens you in this really important way, and it opens you. I mean, anyone whose heart is broken knows that you feel everything when your heart is broken, and the only thing you're attuned to is the presence or absence of love, and that's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing. So in a sense, it's good to heal from it, but the most important thing, I believe, and what I hope the book teaches, is how to stabilize your heart in the state of openness and not...
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's not so much an issue of finding love again. It's being open to love, getting to that place where you know you could love again.
That's really well said. That's really right. And even if you're not in that place and you think you never will be, love doesn't care. You can't game it. And if you feel it and it happens, you may think, oh, I'm not ready, or I am ready.
Oh, I love that. You can't game love. You can't game love. It's one of the stories that you told that was so fascinating was about someone you called in the book, Liz, and that may or may not be her name, but who escaped from heartbreak through a relationship and then got heartbreak in that relationship. She kind of used a relationship, a new relationship, to end her heartbreak, and it was the new relationship then that caused even more heartbreak. So I guess that goes once again to the danger, but being open to love, that is the victory, I suppose, for the warrior, the tenderhearted warrior, right? That's when the tenderhearted warrior knows that she's achieved victory.
Yes. Absolutely. And I don't think it's cultivating an openness. You are already open to love. You just relax into it again.
Relax into it. Well, that's, you know, one of your chapters is called Relax. You have other chapters. And once again, even though this book is not overtly funny, it is so amusing, and it's written in a way that is just so engaging, and part of that is that it's so amusing. One of the chapters that I love, Susan, is where you talk about you can't feel cool with a broken heart. And thought, oh man, that just nails it. That's just the, you know, that's just kind of the gist of the problem, is not only are you feeling pain, you're just feeling uncool.
Yeah, completely uncool. You're like, whatever you thought made you cool, it's like, it doesn't work anymore. So, you know, you just feel like a dork, like 24/7.
Yeah, that is so true and so sad. Then another one of your chapters that I love is Act Like a Queen. And, you know, not only do you tell readers to act like a queen, you tell them exactly how to do it. You want to talk about that some?
Yeah, that was a really fun chapter to write, and I don't know where all that came from. It just sort of popped out one day. But, you know, I guess in spiritual traditions, there's a lot of teachings about rulership, about kingliness, about, you know, monarch, being a monarch of some sense in your own world, whatever that might mean. At least in my spiritual practices, I've come across that concept. But I never really saw the concept of queenliness. And I started thinking one day, well, how would it be different? Here's some rules for teaching someone to act like a king. What would they be to teach someone to act like a queen? And so I just started thinking about it, and I came up with things like a queen is never summoned. And it's, you know, you don't summon, you don't go, hey, come over, or, you know, booty call a queen or anything. You can't summon them. So I just thought, when your heart is broken, it's good to adopt the pose, you know, the inner pose of a queen, whether you're a man or a woman, because you can't be summoned. So good. That's a very dignified thing. Another one is a queen acts like a queen no matter where she is. So, you know, it's like you think of them in their, you know, with their manners and their outfits and their etiquette and all that. But then you don't really think when they get in their house, they put on sweatpants, you know. And just sort of, you know, don't say please or thank you to anyone. It's like they probably are still regal wherever they go. So when your heart is broken, you kind of let things go to pot in a sort of a way, or it's tempting to think I'm worthless, so I don't need to change out of my sweatpants that I've been wearing for 6 weeks. But, you know, if you adopt the pose of a queen and think, you know, I have dignity. I am elegant. Good sounds like a silly word, but I'm a person of bearing, which is true. That really helps heal. It really does.
It's wonderful. You know, the funny thing is that on Sunday night you were to have been our featured guest on the social media soiree, and technology, as it sometimes does, got in the way, so that didn't happen. But it was the joyful romance soiree, and I made a joke, Susan, about your book. I said that since I was such a heartbreaker, I was going to buy just dozens of them, and I was going to use them, you know, that it would be a good way to break up with someone. You just hand them a copy of your book.
Oh, God, that's funny.
Have you ever thought of that as a tool, you know, as a way to sell books and say, you know, you just keep these on hand, and when you're ready to break up with someone, hand it off to them. But actually, when I said that, I had no idea of what a kind thing it would be, because your book is just full of practical advice. Now, for most men, act like a queen is not, you know, probably doesn't, you know, translate. But many of the things do, and you give such practical advice. It's just great. And one thing you have in there that is also amusing, and but you know, just dead on, is your list of untrue things for people.
Right. I'd love to say anybody who wants to should add to that list, because there's so many. And I tried to think of as many as I could, things you believe about yourself when your heart is broken that just aren't true. So, you know, anybody who wants to add to that list, it's on my website, and they should.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And tell people the name or your website. There are links on our website to your website, but it is SusanPiber.com, is it not?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So they can go there. It's actually a thing of beauty. Go for the list of things that are untrue, but also go to read about Susan and her work and just to see a drop-dead beautiful website.
Great.
Your book also has a list of, talk about practical. Your list, a list of DVDs to watch when you're experiencing heartbreak.
Well, yeah, I'm not much of a theoretical person. I'm a very I think of myself anyway as like practical. I what do I do? It's not enough to understand theories or reasons, like why pain hurts. I don't care. You know, what should I do? So I just made these lists of sometimes you really want to laugh, and I asked on Twitter what movies really make you laugh all the time, and no matter how many times you watch them, and I put that list in the book. And sometimes you really want to cry. It's like you just want to give voice to your sorrow, which I think is a good thing to do. Different than wallowing, but feeling is not always wallowing. Much to the counter to the way our culture views feeling. However, I ask people, what movies make you cry? Not because they're like about tragedies, but because they're so touching. And so I put that list in the book too.
Yeah, it's a very interesting list, and you could also just call it a list of good movies. It's a great list. One of your chapters in the book, once again, the one that just strikes me as humor, and this is Women Are Not Funny After All, but you have an idea that you should give your demons a dinner party.
Right. I think that chapter, as well as hopefully the other chapters, they're all about turning towards what is happening to you. And most, advice is about how to turn away from it, how to make it stop. And, of course, you want it to stop, and it will stop. But giving your demons a dinner party is a way of saying to the voices inside of your head that are telling you you're worthless, this is your fault, you should be really angry, or if you hadn't said this, that wouldn't have happened, and I'm ashamed. And to turn towards all those voices and say, you got something to say to me? Let's have a party. I want to hear it. Talk to me. And in your imagination or in your journal or whatever, you sort of picture each demon. You have the shame demon, you have the rage demon, you have the depressed demon, whatever your demons are, and you imagine that you, as you are, not as a demon, are seated at the head of a table, and you ask each one, what are you really trying to tell me? What do you want to tell me? And they may start out saying, you're a loser, or something not so good, but then if you go, well, what are you actually trying to protect me from? They have an answer. They have an answer for you. And so then you hear them, and you go, thank you very much, and the party's over, and I'll take your under advisement what you've said. And you sort of, in an inner way, take the seat of power in your own world. That's what that chapter is meant to help you do.
Yeah, well, it's just a kind of an amazing thing to picture, a dinner party where you've invited your demons. But I have to say, though, another thing that I love about your book is that you also say it's okay to be angry. You have a chapter about the role of anger, and maybe you don't encourage rage, but you are somewhat accepting of it. And I consider anger a human emotion that is sometimes underserved, and so I was glad to see that.
Yeah, anger can be an amazing tool, and it's the most dangerous tool of all. So I don't really suggest that you just start experimenting with it willy-nilly, but there is an extraordinarily wakeful quality in anger. It's like you are awake, you are sharp, you are not tolerating anything but something clear, and that's good. That's helpful, and it's I think I call it in the book wrathful energy. And there's a kind of wrath that is noble. Think of the kind of wrath that's like, don't touch that hot stove, that kind of thing. But it's a very high skill in my estimation, very, very high skill. And only people who really understand anger and how to use it should wield it. And the rest of us should just you know, go to a therapist or calm down before we open our mouths. I personally am very bad at anger. Not that I don't feel it. I feel it just as much as anyone. But I don't, when I express my anger, it makes me feel angrier. It doesn't make me feel spent like some people.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's just me.
Well, one thing about it is that you point out, and I knew it before I read your book. It's something that I've been aware of and something that I suppose I could be envious of. You say you've had better teachers than many, that you've had extraordinary spiritual teachers, and you yourself are a spiritual teacher, have you are in the Buddhist practice and attended a Buddhist seminary. And so the last portion of your book deals with some of that and how to take a meditative approach to heartbreak. And so it's just a real interesting mixture in your book of personal, very specific stories of your experience and others, then all of these practical tips and advice, and then also some spiritual teachings for people to explore. And you do it in a very accessible way, you know, even for people who are not accustomed to the Buddhist practice. But talk a little bit about your training in that field and what you do in that field.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you bringing that up a lot. And for me, the whole book is based in my study and practice of Buddhism, although I don't fling the B word around, you know, because mm-hmm. it's just common sense. Nobody has to adopt any beliefs of any kind to do these things. But for me, it springs from my experience as a student of Buddhism, which I have been since 1995. I am a Buddhist, and I am a meditation teacher, and, you know, I've studied a lot. I'm not saying I'm a great student, but I have studied a lot, and I have practiced. I'm devoted to practice. And so for me, it was when I discovered Buddhism that all of the feelings that I encountered in heartbreak came to me as expressions of wisdom. I saw how they could be expressions of wisdom instead of just pain. So like we were just talking about anger, there's a wakeful quality in it. So there can be wisdom in anger, just like there can be a degraded form of anger. So for me, the study of Buddhism really helped me, it was the first time I ever discovered anything that said, your strong emotions are what's good about you, not what's bad about you. And there's wisdom in them. And so that is what attracted me to the study. And I think, I hope, that's what I try to share, although this is a self-help book, and nobody has to be a Buddhist or adopt any kind of belief, obviously, to do these things. But for me, personally, that's the core of my life. Okay.
Well, tell me this, Susan. What about humor in your life? What is the role of humor in your life?
Well, it's the most important thing, but then I'm like, well, okay, maybe it's not, I don't know. I have to think about that before I said it, but it's crucial. And in my mind, and also in the view of Buddhism, this is true, it is an indication of spiritual depth in a sort of way, because you have to have some kind of openness to see the humor in things. If you're closed and just all grimly focused on your ideas about things, you're very humorless. But humor, when you're touched, you do one of two things. You cry or you laugh. And so it's just as open to sorrow. And so for me, when I find that my sense of humor is gone, that's the biggest red flag I have in my personal life, my spiritual life, just my life. Something's gone wrong. I'm taking myself too seriously. This seems too deadly, and I need to lighten up a little bit because my sense of humor is gone. And so I don't know how to do it, but I need to know that it's a red flag and pay attention to it.
That is a wonderful point and such a wonderful way to end this conversation. Susan, thank you for being with us today. I thoroughly enjoyed the opportunity to learn from you, and good luck with the travels as you go on down the road. I'll be watching on YouTube to see where you go next. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kay. It's just been an absolute delight talking with you, and I hope we can do it again. And I know we'll do it again on Twitter.
I'd love it. Bye-bye.